Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 2 of the ever-expanding Hales from Chambers Medical Law Group series of podcasts with me, Nick Peacock.
And me, Julian Picton.
Now, Julian, I've got a question for you based on one of your extracurricular activities, and it's this Eurovision Song Contest question. Did the right country win this year?
Well, that's a very good question. Nick, I was rooting for Australia. I tipped Finland to win. I thought Bulgaria might surprise us all, and blow me, they did.
They did indeed. Goodness. Right, maybe we'll come back to this. Anyway, look, before we do that, what case are we talking about today, Julian?
Today, Nick, we are talking about the case of Lynch and the Princess Alexandra Hospital NHS Trust, decided earlier this year by Mrs. Justice Ellen Bogan.
Now, it's a long judgment, 389 paragraphs, involving a long and complex analysis of evidence and quantum. Tempting as it is to consider all aspects of the judgment over the next 3 days or so, we have decided to focus on one aspect only, which is...
provisional damages. And what are they?
And the concept is something like this. Where there is a risk at some future point of one or more adverse events, damages can in certain circumstances be awarded in the meantime, hence the word provisional, calculated on the assumption for the time being that the adverse event in question will not happen, but permitting the claimant to return to ask for more money if it does. And Julian, as contributor to the relevant chapter on McGregor on damages, you are well placed, are you not, to help us with the question as to why the law has developed such a remedy, please?
Well, as you know, Nick, I like a difficult damages problem. And one of the biggest problems in the law of damages is the management of uncertainty. The balance of probability works quite well as a cutoff for risks sitting in the middle of the range, but it's a pretty blunt instrument and it's non-functional when it comes to remote risks with catastrophic outcomes. Medicine, as we both know, is filled with remote risks carrying catastrophic outcomes.
Yeah.
To allow for remote medical risks with serious financial consequences, the solution the law's come up with is this thing called provisional as opposed to final awards. It holds the position depending on what the future shows to arise.
Okay, let's have a look at how the issue of provisionals arose in Lynch. And Julian, tell us what the facts were, pithily, as is your wont.
I'll do this as pithily as I can, Nick. The claimant in Lynch was born with developmental dysplasia of the left hip, which the clinicians failed to spot.
DDH.
DDH, indeed. It was only picked up when the claimant was 3, by which time her hip and socket had developed abnormally and her hip was fixed in dislocation. The claimant was 25 years old by the time of the trial. Mm-hmm. In the intervening 22 years, she'd undergone a series of operations, culminating at the age of 22 and a half in a total hip replacement. As anyone who practices in this area will know, hip replacements wear out, sadly. The experts agreed that the claimant would require revision surgery at the ages of 47, 67 and 82. They also agreed that there would be a progressively less satisfactory outcome for each revision, that there was a risk of early implant failure, mm-hmm. of the need for earlier revision surgery, and of other complications requiring less invasive forms of treatment. The worst outcome on the cards was said to be an excision arthroplasty of the entire hip, pretty catastrophic,
yep.
the so-called girdle stone procedure, which would have very major implications for the claimant, very obviously. The better news was the experts agreed the lifetime risk of a girdle stone procedure was less than 1%.
Oh, this sounds like potential provisional damages territory.
It does, Nick, and I rather think you're going to ask me how the judge dealt with that very question.
Go on then, tell us. I know you want to.
I break the suspense. The claimant argued for two categories of provisional damages based on two categories of potential deterioration. The first was a very broad category of adverse outcomes from a variety of origins, and it's worth noting the wording proposed on behalf of the claimant for this category, which was said to be such as to significantly impair her ability to work, carry out domestic tasks, or to engage in leisure and social activities on more than a temporary basis.
So that's all about functional consequences of whatever it is that happens.
It sure is, and that's an important point. The second that she latched onto was the Girdlestone procedure itself. The judge allowed provisional damages for Girdlestone and refused provisional damages for everything else.
Goodness me, how exciting. Okay.
And the next thing you're going to ask me, I rather think, is how the judge reached that conclusion.
Go on. Yes, I'm sure you want to tell us that as well.
I'm bursting with enthusiasm to tell you, Nick, as you can imagine. Rejecting the claimant's broad category, the judge held that the claimant's formulation elided deterioration of the claimant's condition with its effect. Just think about that for a moment. Mm-hmm. That while the claimant had identified complications of revision surgery, she'd not established on balance of probability a more than fanciful chance she would suffer an associated serious deterioration. Have a think about that one too.
Still trying, still caught up in the first one.
Keep up the good work. And that the claimant had identified no clear risk severable from continuing decline, constituting a clear-cut identifiable event or threshold, which, were it to occur, would trigger entitlement to further compensation. Mm. Hold against that analysis, if you will, what the judge held in relation to Girdlestone. For in relation to that, the judge decided that the relevant risk was clear and severable, that the consequences were reasonably ascertainable and serious, and that a once and for all award, which included a sum for the chance of a Girdlestone, would be wholly inadequate to compensate the claimant if the condition materialised, which I suspect is pretty fundamental to this whole jurisdiction.
Yeah, that sounds like classic provisional damages territory.
Well then, Nick, having done my bit of the homework,
tell me
what the criteria are, please, and what we need to look out for when we're considering an award of PDs.
Well, look, dear listener, I'm going to require you to do a little bit of homework. I'm not going to read out the various statutory provisions, but I will refer to them. To understand PDs, you need to read Section 32A of the Senior Courts Act 1981 and the mirror image Section 51 County Courts Act 1984 to understand the statutory jurisdiction. You need to read CPR Part 16 and Practice Direction 16 for what must be pleaded in respect to provisional damages. The court cannot make an award of its own motion. To get them, you must plead them. You then need to read CPR Part 41, especially Rules 41.2 and 41.3, and Practice Direction 41, and the form which is annexed to the practice direction, which is sometimes overlooked. You will then need to read a couple of cases in particular, Wilson, W-I-L-L-S-O-N, and the Ministry of Defence in 1991, and the case of Kotula, K-O-T-U-L-A, and EDF in 2011. And you could do no better than read McGregor on Damages, to which chapter my learned friend Julian Picton KC contributed.
And I just need to stress, Nick, for the avoidance of doubt, it's a former edition, but it survived into the present one. I don't do it anymore.
The excitement never ends, ladies and gentlemen.
It certainly doesn't.
Having read all of those, here is my working summary in three parts. One, is there a measurable, by which I mean more than fanciful, chance that in the future, two, the claimant will suffer a serious condition or a serious deterioration? Three, which would, if it occurred, justify the award of damages. Now, each of those parts, each of those questions, if you like, throws up some issues of principle and procedure, and we're going to have a look at most of those in part two. But as a working assumption, provisional damages are most apt where there's a very small chance of something really bad happening, and the greater the statistical probability of the adverse event, the more amenable it becomes to being built into a full and final award by one means or another. So that's my summary. How's that?
Excellent. And to the point.
Now, we'll consider quite a lot of that in part two. But first, ladies and gentlemen, and very excitingly, an intermission and a very special guest.
Certainly is.
Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the intermission of episode 2 of the ever-increasing Hales from Chambers Medical Law Group series of podcasts. And I have with me a very special guest indeed, ladies and gentlemen, none other than Stephen Smith, Senior Clerk at Hales from Chambers. Welcome, Stephen.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, Nick. It's great to be with you.
Stephen, I wondered if you could remember your first arrival at what is now Hales from Chambers.
I can. It seems so long ago, but I remember arriving in the temple, staring at a very large building, a very handsome building that was covered in black soot, which turned out to be paper buildings. Arrived at the doorstep at number 4, was greeted by a very plush concrete entranceway, arrived through the front door to a nice reception area that was painted white walls and brown lino, single light bulb hanging from the ceiling. And I have to say, it wasn't what I quite expected from a barrister's place of work, but those are my early memories.
Well, insert your own joke here, but I like to think that the decor has improved somewhat.
Just a tad, I think.
I mean, you've been here a long time, Stephen. You must have some fond memories of events here.
Probably too many to list, but the sort of highlights, being appointed the senior clerk at a very early age, seeing pupils come through the system to become members of chambers and then go on to take silk and onto the bench.
Yeah.
I did enjoy the years where there were no emails, no computers and no mobile phones. It might sound a bit sort of antiquated, but they were good times.
I don't think you're entirely alone in that. I thought I was an early starter with a mobile phone in 1992. Listen, we're a medical law podcast. Tell us, in your view, how medical litigation has developed, I suppose, over your time here.
Yes, I mean, fortunately, when I arrived in 1975, the chambers had already an established medical practice in that we were representing doctors, mm-hmm. hospitals, and acting for plaintiffs, as they then were, but yeah. obviously now claimants.
Yeah.
We had two or three very prominent members that were doing the work, but the main person really that took this work forward was Jean Ritchie. She was a very popular and sought after junior for medical work, medical cases, and we just hit the time right with her practice. It became more commonplace for the public to sue the hospitals, and it just led on from there.
Yeah, and Jean is in fact the reason I'm here. If you could change one aspect of medical litigation, or more than one, what would you change, do you think?
I think for me, the main one that I would change would be to reintroduce or reinstate legal aid, so that the public would have a wider access to the legal system to try and seek compensation for unfortunate errors that have been made.
Yeah, I don't think you're alone in that either. Anything else?
Probably slightly controversial, but I would, from a chamber's point of view, I would certainly recommend that we would reinstate success fees to CFAs. Having gone this far down the road now, we know how they work. I think the bar was slightly hoodwinked in terms of having to accept work on a CFA without the success fee.
Well, you have our best interests at heart, Stephen.
As always.
Never let it be said otherwise. Now, look, we've had a bit of a work chat. I know outside work you are something of an amateur Egyptologist. So answer me this. Who is your favourite pharaoh and why?
Good question. Yeah, well, I like to think of myself as I've got a fascination with ancient civilizations, but certainly Egypt is one of the top at the top. For me, it's Ramesses the Great, without question. I know a lot of people turn to King Tut because of the treasures, but Ramesses the Great was an incredible leader. I mean, he ruled in his era for 66 years.
Good Lord.
He was a prolific builder of monuments, temples, images of himself all over the place, just to show everybody how wealthy and powerful he was.
Yeah.
He lived until, they say, 1991. And he had over 100 children.
Good Lord. Right.
But for somebody to live into their 90s...
In those times.
5,000 years ago, he's quite an incredible, apart from his other achievements. It's quite impressive.
Well, there we go. Look, Stephen, it's been absolutely great to have you on the podcast. Thank you very much for coming.
No, my pleasure. And thank you. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Ladies and gentlemen, rejoin us please in a moment or two when Julian and I return to you with part two of episode two of the semi-legendary Hailsham Chambers Medical Law Group series of podcasts. See you in a moment. Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to part two of episode two of the Hailsham Chambers Medical Law Group podcast with me, Nick Peacock.
And me, Julian Picton.
Now, Julian, I'm going to follow up on the Eurovision Song Contest with this. Did this year's UK entry deserve more than 1 point?
Nick, the UK entry volunteered that his song was Marmite. Speaking purely for myself, I prefer peanut butter or chocolate spread.
I think I'm going to take that as a no, but I'm not entirely sure. So, look, what are the circumstances in which practitioners should be alert to the potential for an award of provisional damages?
The two scenarios which immediately occur to me are brain injury and epilepsy and spinal injury and syrinx.
Yeah, okay. I mean, the one that occurs to me straight off the bat is eyes. So loss of vision in one eye really ought to prompt you into making a claim for provisional damages for loss of vision in the other eye. And indeed, that's what the chapter in the JC guidelines says. And I suppose you could extend that to any paired bodily organ like kidneys.
I see that.
Next one that occurred to me, psychiatric damage in adolescence. So imagine significant scarring in very young life. Let's say around the face, for example, which you can imagine might become much more prominent, noticeable in adolescence and provoke a psychological reaction to that. And indeed, I have dealt with one undersettlement case arising out of the failure to contemplate or plead provisional damages in just those circumstances.
So what's the key message, do you think?
Well, I think provisional damages should always be on your checklist. I mean, they should just be automatic. I mean, many times you'll say, no, we don't need to think about it. But as often as not, you will.
I entirely agree with that. This is an area where elephant traps are bound for the unwary. So give us a hint of the traps we need to be looking out for, Nick.
Well, I'm a bearer of very small legal brain. I'm anxious to avoid elephant traps if I can. Number one on my list, I suppose, damages are calculated and awarded at trial, as I've said, on the assumption that the adverse event will not happen. Now, if that seems counterintuitive to you, you are just going to have to think about what provisional damages are all about until you have the light bulb moment and it sinks in. I promise you, you will, but it may take a while. Next, part 36 offers. This is a bit more tricky. You can make a full and final offer to a claimant who claims provisional damages. You can even top it up, if you like, with a premium to buy off the provisional damages claim, but it will not be protective if at trial the claimant is awarded provisional damages. Read CPR 36.19. Now, my analogy is this. In a provisional damages case, the claimant is seeking a sum of money now and a lottery ticket. To counter that by protective CPR Part 36 offer, you're going to have to offer a sum of money and a lottery ticket. In fact, the same lottery ticket. But what you can't do is say at trial, if the claimant succeeds in an award of provisional damages, well, hang on, we valued the lottery ticket element and made a monetary offer for the claim, including the lottery ticket, because the lottery ticket only has a monetary value when it crystallizes in the future. Next, you can only make one future application per serious condition or deterioration.
Which is a highly important point given the kinds of condition we're contemplating.
Indeed. Next, and finally, an order is required under CPR 41.2, including lodging all sorts of stuff at court and the rule and practice direction set out which documents are required. So that's my list.
Well, let's have a go at difficult areas, because there are a fair few of those too.
Sure are. I guess number one has got to be, well, what does serious mean? I mean, I think, firstly, you've got to think in terms of a clear-cut event.
My next on the list is that we have to be particularly careful in defining the condition that we're interested in. It's got to be defined with precision, and it's got to be pleaded.
Yeah, and that came up in Lynch, didn't it?
It certainly did, and indeed we'll come back to that when we consider the decision in Lynch in its own terms. Following on from it, and indeed according to Lynch, we've got to remember we're only interested in a specified medical condition, not broad symptoms. The broad category, you'll recall, got ruled out. And the next one on my list is that we have to bear in mind the difficulty separating out a predictable deterioration, which of course is allowed for in the assessment of prognosis anyway, from the risk to be covered by PDs.
Yeah, so arthritis, I think, is a prime example of that.
It's a prime example of that.
Yeah, okay.
Anything else?
Yeah, my list, causation. Now, the question is always, do you argue causation first time out, or do you argue it at the rematch? Actually, there is, in practice direction 41, para 2.5, an answer to this, although I suppose you could question the vires of this in a practice direction, but it says, causation of any further damages within the scope of the order shall be determined when any application for further damages is made. In other words, at the rematch.
And I think that's important too. We'll come back to that in due course. But what about the cases where the index negligence increases the risk of the adverse condition or deterioration? What do you make of them?
Well, I suppose my answer is stems from the answer I've just given about causation and practice direction 41. I think it's covered by that. In other words, whether the serious condition or deterioration has been caused by the index negligence is always a matter for the rematch. Now, the question of whether the index negligence has increased the risk of the adverse event caught by provisional damages must therefore, to my mind, be a question for the rematch, and we resort to standard causation principles.
Well, I strongly agree with that. Let's just turn our minds, though, to the predicament we're all pretty familiar with, and that's, how do you deal with provisional damages in the context of settlements?
Well, on the assumption that you don't want to accept an award for provisional damages, and the very good reasons for defendants not wanting to, and understandable reasons, then you're going to have to pay a premium. I suppose the question is, how then do you calculate the premium, or how do you advise your client, your claimant client, that it's enough? So I think not by a strict application of the mathematical percentage risk which your experts have identified to the likely sum of damages if the risk eventuates, because that would defeat the whole purpose. You could do that now. Not, I think, a lump sum just for the sake of it. I think only two options really remain. One is either a sort of suitably uplifted percentage of the award if the risk were to eventuate, or some kind of lump sum based on the need that one might have at the acute moment when the conditional deterioration happens. In other words, what would you absolutely need to get you over the hump?
I agree with that. In essence, what you're saying is that if we're settling provisional damages, it must be for enough to make a difference.
Yeah, it's got to make a practical difference.
Merely 0.35% of 2 million or something is neither here nor there if you end up in a wheelchair 5 years' time.
I don't think that's quite the right approach. Anyway, look, I mean, ultimately, whether the premium is sufficient will depend on factors like the age, I suppose, capacity as well of the claimant, the likelihood of the adverse event in question, the willingness of the claimant to contemplate a full and final settlement in the circumstances, and I guess what they are going to need if the risk eventuates. Those are the things which strike me as germane.
And that leaves
the major
question, Nick.
I think I threatened to come back to this.
You did.
Now, Julian, was Lynch correctly decided in the light of all that we have discussed?
Well, you know me, Nick. Ever one to stick my neck out? In my view, no.
Ah, goodness.
I think the judge created a distinction between the form and the cause of the deterioration, which doesn't in fact exist in law, and as a result got involved in issues of medical causation, which, as you very recently reminded us, should only arise when the claimant comes back for a second helping. I think the judge ruled out PDs for outcomes short of Girdlestone when she shouldn't have done.
Goodness. Goodness. I mean, the controversy never ends, does it, with this podcast?
Well, that's the whole point.
Okay, well, look, that brings us to the end, ladies and gentlemen, of the second episode of the ever-expanding Hailsham Medical Law Group series of podcasts. Correspondence on the Eurovision Song Contest, direct to Julian, please, not me. Julian, any final words for the dear listeners?
Nick, in the inimitable words of Mr. Ray Parker Jr., if there's something strange in your childhood, who you're going to call Hailsham Chambers.
The end. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the Hailsham Chambers Medical Law Group. The presenters were Nick Peacock and Julian Picton, KC. Produced by Jamie Harley, this podcast comprises legal commentary, not legal advice. All rights reserved.